Okay, the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The first case on our docket is 20-50225, United States versus McElroy. Mr. Smith.
Yes, Your Honor. Should I go ahead?
Yes.
Oh, okay. May it please the court, my name is Peter Smythe. I represent Kevin McElroy. Mr. McElroy is currently serving a 24-month revocation sentence after a revocation hearing where he pleaded not true to all of the government's allegations. The government's evidence, only evidence at the revocation hearing, was a lab report that it introduced at the time of the hearing. We presented two issues on appeal. One, and they're interrelated actually. They center on this court's prior decision in Granlund, the rule set down in Granlund in 1996. We claim that the government failed to comply with Granlund, and therefore its noncompliance and the district court's noncompliance actually should work to effectuate vacatur and dismissal of the petition. Also, the government's failure and the district court's failure worked to a revocation sentence that was based upon insufficient evidence when looking at the lab report. Going back to the Morrissey case, the Morrissey case established the right, a defendant's right to confront and cross-examine adverse witnesses unless the hearing officer specifically found good cause for not allowing the confrontation. When reading Morrissey, the concurrence and also the dissent, that good cause related to informants. It didn't relate to any other matters, actually. After Morrissey, we come to the Caldera case, and that's where a police officer introduced the lab test, and that was reversed and remanded under the Sixth Amendment. The Bentley case came next and applied the Sixth Amendment, but found harmless error. And then, interestingly enough, in Kindred in 1990, the court changed the criteria and said that Caldera was inconsistent, and now it was going by Rule 32.1 and applying a balancing test. In that case,
this is under plain error, correct?
Yes.
Is that, yes, do you concede that?
I'm sorry?
Do you concede that our review is under plain error?
Actually, no, Your Honor, because of Granlund. I think Granlund actually introduces a new element that the court needs to review. Because if the court
did you object on that basis in the district court?
In the district court, the trial lawyer made a constitutional objection. He did not mention Granlund by name, no.
Okay, so what I'm saying is you failed to make a proper objection to the argument that you're now making. And so don't we have to review that under plain error? Under plain error review, it requires you to make certain showings of prejudice and, I mean, the four steps of plain error review.
Well, Your Honor, I think the Granlund rules actually add another layer, because the Granlund rules talk about confrontation. And although the trial lawyer did not mention Granlund by name, you know, the rules of federal evidence don't apply to these hearings. And he gave the district court enough notice that The district court was put on notice. Also, Granlin is a mandatory rule under this circuit's case law. So the government was obligated to file the lab reports and all the Granlin elements at least 5 days.
You're obligated to make a proper objection, and I'm asking you whether the objection that you made with respect to the denial of cross-examination is satisfactory to raise all of the elements of the Granlin to the Granlin rule.
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, tell me why.
I'm sorry?
Tell me why.
Because the trial lawyer said, I'll make a constitutional objection, and he said the lab technicians are not here. And later on in page 154, he says, same objection I previously made regarding the Sixth Amendment hearsay. The crux of Granlin is that Granlin wants to protect the due process rights of the defendant under the Sixth Amendment or under the Fifth Amendment. I mean, that's what Granlin says. It wants to assure...
But Granlin does not apply in this case, as I understand the case, unless you can show and satisfy the plain error analysis. And if you can't show that you're entitled under the plain error analysis for us to review it, we have no right to review it because you failed to make the proper objection. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think plain error is present in the record. What you have is just a lab report that constitutes maybe element one of Granlin that was admitted over objection. The Granlin elements 2, 3, and 4.
Just tell me, how were you prejudiced? How were you prejudiced by the district court failure to follow the government in this case, failure to follow the Granlin rule? How were you prejudiced?
Well, because the district court admitted the evidence over objection, and it was a confrontation objection.
Yeah, but that doesn't indicate you were prejudiced ultimately.
Well, when the district court decided the case solely on the lab report.
Okay. Go ahead.
The plain error occurs when, well, you have plain error when the district court disregards the Granlin criteria, which is a mandatory rule, but then under the revocation law, the district court abuses its discretion when it decides to revoke when the evidence does not meet a preponderance of the evidence. And that's the situation that you have here. You have a lab report that is a bare lab report that does not have chain of custody information on it. There's no scientific methodology. Those things that were required of Granlin to what? Assure that, Granlin says to assure the reliability of the lab reports being introduced to evidence. So the government disregards the mandatory rule and has this lab report admitted over objection, and the district court doesn't make any explicit findings of its reliability, which it's required to do. It just overrules the objection, which is a confrontation objection, which was proper and which was sufficient to put the district court on notice what the objection was. And just based solely upon that evidence at the hearing, the government didn't present any other evidence. The government in its brief says that the district court could have relied on Mr. McElroy's admission to the probation officer about crack use, but that was not presented at the hearing. The government says that the district court could have relied on Mr. McElroy's admission to the probation officer about meth use. That was not presented at the hearing. The necessity of inpatient treatment, that was not presented at the hearing. or the lengthy history of cocaine use in the PSR. The PSR was not presented at the hearing. So the only evidence that the district court could rely on in revoking Mr. McElroy's supervised release was this lab report. And then we do go back to Granlin. And I guess the question before the court is whether Granlin is a mandatory rule or not. This court has recognized that it is. And if the government decides that it's not going to
comply. What do you mean a mandatory rule?
The Granlin explicitly says that the following procedures were missing for all future revocation hearings involving positive laboratory tests. And then also in the Minute case, I believe that Minute recognizes.
In other words, it does not require, you're saying that mandatory means that the district court was obligated to do it, notwithstanding the fact that you made no objection to its failure to follow the rule.
Actually, I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that's a correct reading of Granlin, and I think it's a correct reading of the court's reference in Minutes, because Granlin says what? It's for all future revocations. These are the procedures that the government needs to do in order to what? Have positive laboratory tests admitted into revocation hearings. Now, the Granlin is not a suggestion. It's not a recommendation. So if the government does not comply, the question is, who's harmed? Well, in this case, Mr. McElroy is harmed.
Counsel, can you address in your remaining time or some of your remaining time your passive ingestion argument?
Well, yes, Your Honor. That was raised by defense counsel in the cross-examination of the probation officer. I think, frankly, in going back to the laboratory test that was admitted in the hearing, there is no methodology with that test. There's no affidavit with that test. As I reviewed the report, I don't even know what kind of test was done. And so I think what the trial lawyer was doing after admittance, he was cross-examining the probation officer to show the district court that this lab report constituting element one of the Granlin criteria was not reliable. Because it did not, there's no methodology shown, there's no methodology of disregarding false positives and the rest. When you look at the lab report itself, there's no collector's name, it does not line up with Granlin at all. And so it does come back to the question I think before the court is Granlin just... does it boil down to be a recommendation that the government can disregard, or is it mandatory in order for the government to have these lab reports admitted? Because when you see the history of the cases, the government cites over and over again McCormick, which was in 1995, and then Granlin is decided in 96. And this court in 96 says, okay, from here on out, this is what the government needs to do to assure reliability of lab reports. And this reliability, this is what the government needs to do. And then the district court needs to make explicit findings on the records about that reliability. If the lab report, say in this case, doesn't line up with Granlin, then there is a presumption that it's unreliable because it doesn't meet the Granlin criteria. But going back to the court's question, I don't believe that the trial lawyer needs to object based upon Granlin because Granlin is mandatory. You know, that's what this court has set out to do. If it's not mandatory, then this court can rescind or modify the Granlin order. But Granlin does say that from here on out, we invoke our supervisory authority and direct the following procedures for all future revocation hearings involving positive laboratory tests. And it lays that out, what, to assure the reliability of those tests in revocation hearings.
Okay, thank you, counsel. You saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Durbin.
Good morning. May it please the court, Richard Durbin for the United States. Judge Jolly, to first address the one of the questions you raised concerning the standard of review. As I read the record of the revocation hearing, there were basically, two or three objections. There was an objection that was based on the Sixth Amendment right to confront or cross-examine, the lab technician. It wasn't entirely clear who he wanted to cross-examine. He invoked the Sixth Amendment, but I suspect that is adequate to invoke the qualified confrontation right that the courts have recognized in the context of parole hearings and revocation hearings. That was one objection. There was no objection based on Granlin. There was no objection. In fact, there was no challenge to the accuracy of the result of the lab report. The issue at this hearing, and it was a strategic issue that both Mr. McElroy referred to and the lawyer referred to at the beginning of the hearing, the strategic issue was not whether or not this was a positive result. That wasn't in contest. What was in contest was whether Mr. McElroy had knowingly ingested cocaine, which would result in a finding that he knowingly possessed cocaine, which would result in automatic revocation and more time in jail. That was what the issue was at the hearing. The lab report, this court has considered a number of cases involving this type of hearsay, and I would contrast it with the type of case where the hearsay is a who saw what out-of-court witness, such as an informant or a victim of a crime. And in those cases, this court has scrutinized it fairly closely and has said, no, those in the balance of the defendant's interest in cross-examination against the government's interest essentially in efficiency, the defendant's interest outweighs it. But in the case of lab reports, these are business records. They're done by companies that are in the business of doing these kinds of analyses. It's not in the record, but I would suggest the probation offices in this circuit do a lot of these. They collect a lot of these samples. They move a lot of them along. There is a process here, and there was no challenge to the integrity of the process in this particular instance. I mean, for example, the custodian of records, the certification, was by a Patricia Pizzo. Ms. Pizzo's name occurs in several of this court's cases. She's the lab director now for Abbott, but she was at one time the lab director for Kroll. She was the subject in part, or she was a witness in the Minute case. There wasn't a question about the integrity of this. As far as the methodology, the report indicates it was gas chromatograph mass spectrometry, or it was liquid chromatograph and tandem mass spectrometry. That was the method of confirmation. And there was a validity test that was done, testing the specific gravity, the creatinine, and the pH. So the lab report wasn't some blank thing. And I suspect that counsel looked at it as a strategic matter and said, the question is, on this lab report basis, can the court make a finding that it was not passive ingestion? Now, there was no evidence offered of passive ingestion. Mr. McElroy didn't testify. He didn't call a witness. He didn't subpoena a lab technician. And as court has said, where there are those kinds of challenges, there's not a strong interest in cross-examination because the defendant or the releasee can seek that evidence if that's what he wants to put on. That evidence was not put on in this circumstance. And so the sole question was, well, should the lab tech be called so he can cross-examine the lab tech on some other issue? I'm not sure that it's been shown on this record that the lab tech would have been able to be informative on the particular issue that he was raising, the defense that he was raising to this. And that is, what amount, how many nanograms per milliliter of a metabolite is enough that it will exclude an inference of passive ingestion? What was established in this particular proceeding was not just the lab report, but all of those other things that counsel referenced, they're in the record. There were a series of reports that included positive urinalysis. There was one, I think, in the middle of 2018. There were several positive analyses in the July-August timeframe of 2019. Mr. McElroy acknowledged that he had been using, he admitted even that he had been using for a 2-week period of time. The one that he contested was the one that was the basis for the revocation petition in motion in this particular proceeding. And that was the lab sample that was taken by CELMAR, which was a counseling service that he was attending following inpatient treatment that he'd had in Houston. And that was the one that was the basis for the revocation or the finding of possession and use. And what we submit, and we said it in our briefing, is that there was considerable evidence in the form of his long history of addiction, of substance abuse, the positive analyses that he did not contest, did not deny, in fact, he acknowledged that year and the prior year. And I would also point the court to Mr. McElroy's allocution in front of the district court, because Mr. McElroy specifically said at the end of it all, and he made reference to a conversation he had had with his probation officer, Mr. Hale, but he also said, I could tell you how this dirty UA, your analysis, came up, and I know you would probably sit there and say no, and then the court cut him off, because the court, I think, was trying to give deference to the position, the strategic position that counsel had taken. But I think that if you read this record, there's no question that Mr. McElroy tested positive. That was not what was in dispute. The dispute was whether or not this was passive. He offered no evidence of that. And as he started to give an explanation, he was cut off, and his lawyer, frankly, didn't want him to give the explanation. We moved to supplement the record with two letters that Mr. McElroy wrote to the court following the sentencing, in which he apologized for taking the position he did at his plea, but he did it on advice of counsel, which to me implies that Mr. McElroy fully understands, and in his allocution he did understand. He acknowledged that he basically self-medicates, and the district court in sentencing him said, you need to not self-medicate. You have had a serious problem for a long time. I wish you luck in trying to solve it. And in passing the sentence, the court sentenced him to 24 months, but the court did not sentence him to a further term of supervised release, because I think it basically reflected they've tried. They've gone through the steps they could to try to help him with his problem, and they were going to take it out of the courts. He was going to serve his punishment, and then he's going to have to deal with his childhood trauma, his post-traumatic stress disorder, and outside of the correction system for a time. But that's what I think it was. As I see the case, there are sort of three issues. You know, the first is, was the report properly admitted? Or was there some sort of remedy that should be available under Grandland? I don't find a case where this court has granted some kind of relief on a failure to comply with all of the steps of Grandland. And I don't know that you will find one, because under the rules of evidence, this report was properly admitted. It was a business record and it was unobjected to.
What is your response to Mr. Smyth's argument that this is a quote mandatory end quote rule that does not require counsel to make any objection for the failure to follow it?
Well, I don't know where what it means to say that it's mandatory. It's a rule that Judge Politz devised in a case that actually I happened to argue 25 years ago, and it sort of came out of nowhere. And I think that he was expressing a frustration with these kinds of issues that come up over and over again. And I think he was trying to solve something, but Grandland wasn't addressing a problem that the parties had in this case. There was not a challenge to who took the sample. Mr. McElroy knew who took that sample. He gave it. There wasn't a challenge to what the chain of custody was, and there wasn't a challenge to the methodology or the outcome or the result. And in litigation, parties make those kinds of determinations. I may allow in hearsay because, although it's hearsay, it's not a mandatory requirement that it not come in. And in some instances, it's more efficient. And in some instances, it gets in evidence that I'd like to get in anyway, and I'm not quite sure how else to do it. And then to come afterward and say, oh, well, I think that hurt me in the end. That wasn't a very good decision. Now it's a mandatory rule. It shouldn't have come in. I don't think that's what Grandland is. I think what Grandland was going to was trying to perhaps create some kind of routine, normalcy. But you know, I can't tell you that every lab company is going to necessarily follow that. And if the parties go into the proceeding sort of understanding what the groundwork is, well, why do we need to jump through all the hoops to get long drawn out affidavits of what everybody did when everybody pretty much knows what they did? The outcome wasn't what the issue was. And it wasn't a claim that it wasn't in his blood. That wasn't what the defense was.
Yeah, but you have to acknowledge, I suppose, that these reports were not given to the defendant 5 days before sentencing.
I'm not sure of that, Judge, because the lab report was done before the certification by Ms. Pizzo. The certification by Ms. Pizzo came on March 17th, and the hearing was on March the 18th. I do not know when the lab report was produced. It may have been produced as part of that, but I don't know that it wasn't produced earlier. I'm seeing my internet connection is unstable. And he didn't complain about it. I mean, that's what I go back to is if that were the issue.
There was no objection.
There wasn't even no objection. There wasn't even a complaint. I mean, and lawyers are good with complaints even when they don't have an objection.
Complaints and objections are sometimes very synonymous, I think.
Well, the other issue is whether confrontation was denied. That's the sort of the question of, is there a problem with the court's failure to make an express finding of good cause? I think that the balance comes down. There was an implicit finding here. The integrity of the testing process was not contested. The matter that Mr. McElroy and his lawyer wanted to get into was not really the subject of cross-examination of the lab technician. There might have been witnesses that could testify to how many nanograms
What did they want to get into through cross-examination?
Don't know for sure, but what I think it was about the passive ingestion. I think that's what the issue was, because that's what the back and forth was between the government counsel and the defense lawyer, was about what the meaning of Courtney was and whether the cutoff was 100 nanograms or 300 nanograms per milliliter. And I mean, this court said in Minute, where basically the releasee doesn't put on any evidence at all about passive ingestion, well, then their rights are not violated if they're not allowed to cross-examine. And so he didn't even really lay the foundation, but, you know, sort of positing for, okay, he's raised enough of a question. And the lab report says that the testing level was 100 nanograms and above. And so I mean, I'm not going to argue to this court that the
lab report. But if he had been allowed to cross-examine that this was a result of ingestion, and the district court believed that, the result in this case would be different, would it not?
Well, it could be, but what I'm saying is,
why shouldn't the district court have allowed cross-examination on that particular point?
Because we have no idea that witness knows anything about that. That's what my point is.
You don't know it until you ask him.
Well, but, you know, he's the one who's raising this as a challenge to the lab report. And this court has said, for those kinds of challenges to scientific facts, the defendant can call witnesses. He didn't subpoena the lab technician. He didn't ask for more time to get the lab technician there. He didn't say we absolutely must have somebody from Alere Laboratories or Abbott Laboratories. He could have done any of those things, but he argued with the prosecutor about how many nanograms.
Are you telling us that he had all the information that would have been provided him under Granlund at his fingertips so that that he could examine everything that Granlund would have provided?
I don't know that I can say that, Judge. What I can say is
if he did not have everything that Granlund provided and he was asking for cross-examination to establish the fact that this lab report resulted from ingestion and not from his willful use of cocaine, that would have been the most relevant thing in the entire hearing. That would have exonerated him if the court had believed it.
But that's not what's in the Granlund affidavit. That's not in there. Answering that question is not part of the Granlund information. That's beyond the Granlund.
I don't know what is in the packet.
The Granlund affidavit talks about what the laboratory process was, what the chain of custody was, what the methodology was, and what the result was. It does not talk about excluding all possible other theories for how the metabolite could get in there. If, for example, he'd come in and said, I'm taking coricidin, and I think that gave a false positive.
Well, why couldn't
Granlund isn't going to answer that question.
Why couldn't he cross-examine the lab technician about that to establish that that particular test would not eliminate the possibility that he could have achieved that result by ingestion and not by willful consumption?
Well, I have two answers to it, Judge. First of all, he didn't show that there's any likelihood or possibility at all that the lab technician can answer that kind of question, because I don't think that's what their expertise is. And second of all, if that's what he wanted to prove, he could subpoena the witness. And he had opportunity to subpoena the witness, but he didn't. He could have asked the court, can we have more time to get this person here? He didn't ask for that. He didn't even put his own client on the stand to explain why it was passive ingestion. There's no evidence in the record about passive ingestion. It's all his suggestion. There's nothing in the record to support a question of passive ingestion. And as this court said in Minute, with that, he has no right to cross-examine. We didn't get to that issue.
Are you telling me that no lab report of any kind could have distinguished between willful ingestion and a willful consumption and ingestion through the air or whatever it is?
I don't know the answer to that, Judge. I don't know. I don't know that science.
If he'd cross-examined him, it seems to me that he might well have established that. He could have established, look, we can't tell the difference. No, my client says that he did it by ingestion. Is that possible? The lab technician would say, yes, that's possible as far as I know. Then he's on his way to making some kind of case.
Might have, could have, would have, I don't know, Judge, but that's not in this record. He didn't make that record. He didn't make that objection, and he didn't make efforts to call that kind of witness. If that's what he wanted to put on, he had the opportunity to do it. And in this particular circumstance, he hasn't shown that the concerns about what the expense is, what delays are. The laboratory is in Gretna, Louisiana, and the hearing was in Midland, Texas. That's not just a simple matter of calling somebody to come across the street because we're going to have a hearing, we're going to talk to you. That's a two-day trip, at least. He didn't put on any advance notice.
It's a two-year trip. It's a two-year trip for the defendant.
Well, perhaps. But as I say, I mean, he had the opportunity to put that stuff on, but the government not calling the lab technician didn't violate his confrontation right. And that's what the issue is here. And the other issue is the sufficiency of the evidence. And as I've already summarized, I think the evidence was sufficient. Both the strategic decision they made, plus the evidence of his prior use, the prior positives, the uncontested, that all of those were sufficient to find no abuse.
I thought Ms. Uresti did testify that it was possible that this result could have been obtained by passive ingestion.
I can't quote her, Judge. I'm not going to dispute that. I think Ms. Uresti basically didn't know. She couldn't say it was, and she couldn't say it wasn't.
She said it was possible.
Possible. There's a lot of things that are possible. But that's our position. If you have no questions,
but the defendant himself never testified I think he did say this. I don't know whether he testified that I did not intentionally, willfully consume cocaine, and this is by passive ingestion. Did he testify to that under oath?
No, sir, he did not. His statement to the court was, I could tell you how this dirty UA came up, and I know you would probably sit there and say no, you know, and the court cut him off. So he knew there was a reason for it, but he didn't.
But his counsel didn't say, let us explain why.
No.
The witness did.
I'm sorry?
The witness says to the court, as I understand what you've said, let me explain why or what, and the court says, no, I'm not going to hear it.
That was Mr. McElroy.
That's what I'm saying, that he was going to explain to the court that, look, I got this by passive ingestion, and if the expert had already testified that it could have occurred by passive ingestion, and the witness was willing to state under oath that it did incur through passive ingestion, it seems to me that the witness here is prejudiced by the fact that the district court did not permit that examination or permit that answer.
Well, no, the defendant was represented by a lawyer, and the lawyer got up at the outset and said, we have to contest this because if he's found to be in possession, it's a mandatory revocation. And I think that Mr. McElroy, as I read the record and his subsequent letters, he knew that there was dirty urine. He knew there was a positive. He knew why. But the lawyer's position was, we're going to call this passive ingestion, and we're not going to acknowledge enough to make it use. And we don't know. There is no evidence of passive ingestion. And I don't take Mr. McElroy's words as being passive ingestion. I take that as, I got too close to something and I made a mistake. That's how I read it, Judge. I think it's evidence that he did knowingly use.
Well, we don't know, really. I mean, we don't know the full picture if the court wouldn't let him explain his position. And that seems to me a denial of due process of some sort, but it's ultimately prejudicial. I don't know.
I don't know either, Judge. But
and the court cut him off and didn't let him do it.
I'm not sure that's what was going on, Judge. I think what was going on is that the defense was, we're not going to talk about this. And then Mr. McElroy in his allocution started to talk about it some. And the judge said, before he gave allocution, he said, I'm going to give you an opportunity to testify without being cross-examined. Well, that's not exactly fair either. And I think the judge was trying to make sure that Mr. McElroy didn't say something that was inconsistent with the position that he and his lawyer had taken through the hearing. That's how I read the court saying, okay, be careful where you're going here. I think that's what it was about. I think he was trying to prevent him from making an admission is what the court was doing. I don't think the court was trying to keep out evidence of passive ingestion.
All of this is speculation, Mr. Durbin.
Well, that's the record that I have, Judge Jolly.
You have to work with what you have. That's true.
I know we have to draw the inference from it. And they, you know, the bottom line to me is, look, at the end of the day, the issue that he was not contesting that he had dirty urine. That's not an issue. So Granlund is interesting, but it didn't make any difference. The issue at the end of the day was his cross-examination right cut off? Well, it didn't. My position is he could have called those witnesses if he wanted them. And second of all, he didn't show that the lab technician was going to be somebody who could answer that kind of question in any event. So his confrontation right wasn't violated.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank
Ms. Engelhardt, would you add 3 minutes to rebuttal?
This is five.
Yes, Your Honors. In response to Mr. Durbin about Granlin, I think he's incorrect with that. One thing Judge Jolly brought out is if the government had complied with Granlin like it was supposed to, that would constitute pretty much a notice and demand statute that is talked about in Melendez-Diaz. And that is where the government has testimonial hearsay evidence that it wants to produce against the defendant. And the defendant, after looking at the evidence, can object or not object. And that's one of the reasons why I suppose that Granlin is the rule that it is.
Let me ask you this question about the, aside from this argument, is your client in jail now?
Yes. Okay. Yes, he's still incarcerated. The last time I spoke with him.
What's his proposed release date? Do you know?
I didn't look that up, Judge. He was going to be released to a halfway house the last time I spoke with him, which was, I think, 2 weeks ago. Other than that, he was still incarcerated over in Segoville, Texas.
So, I mean, if we don't give some relief within a few weeks or at least a few months, this case is moot.
Yes, he will have served his entire sentence. Yes, Your Honor. Yes. And, that does bring to bear somewhat the Granlin rule, I think, in these revocation hearings, because what happened here was the only evidence that I see in the record is that the government filed the lab report the day of the hearing. We don't know whether it is that morning. We don't know whether it's at the time of the hearing or even after. Mr. Durbin makes a big deal about, well, the defendant had all these options, but actually the lab report seems to be as sprung at the time of the hearing. That's one thing that Granlin says shouldn't happen. The defendant, as part, I think, of due process, because Granlin, after going through all these cases after Morrissey, decides this is what we're going to obligate the government to do in these cases with this particular kind of evidence. And the district court needs to put explicitly on the record why it is reliable. That is a protection against hearings very much like this one. Because we complain about the sufficiency of the lab report, there's the methodology is missing, the chain of custody is missing, and Mr. Durbin responds and says, well, everybody knows. Well, that's kind of like just saying, well, everybody knows that Mr. McElroy violated, so what's the problem? The problem here is due process. And Mr. Durbin refers to all these alleged admissions, and even as far back as PSR 2011, but none of that was presented by the government at the hearing. You know, when we go and look at Morrissey, Mr. McElroy is entitled to due process. Confrontation is confrontation. It's not something else. That's under Crawford. So what the court has done, I think actually it's a smart thing that the court has done with Granlin, is to obligate, if the government wishes to admit laboratory reports in revocation hearings, this is what it has to do. If it doesn't do that, question is, what is the remedy? Is the remedy what we see here in this hearing, where the defendant goes away for 2 years and the government makes arguments saying, well, everybody knew what was going on? I think if a party has an affirmative obligation and it doesn't conform to that obligation, then the result should be that it doesn't benefit from that failure.
Well, I mean, also the defendant has an affirmative obligation to object.
Yes, Your Honor.
The district court has the right to have the objection presented to him and not find out about it on appeal.
Well, and that goes back.
Could have corrected its error at that time if you had made the proper objection. You didn't do it.
Well, Your Honor, and that goes back to, I guess this court should examine Granlin to see whether it is mandatory or actually whether it's optional. Because if
you're
if
not explaining, not explaining my satisfaction what you mean by mandatory, there's a lot of mandatory rules that are certainly subject to object to waiver on appeal.
Right.
And this right. is not from like, I don't know. I mean, there are very few rules that are automatically imposed on the judge without any kind of objection from the party.
Well, you know, Your Honor, in preparing for oral argument, I took another look at Granlin because I was prepared to say that the government can choose to comply with Granlin, or at the hearing, it can produce live witnesses. But going back to the text of Granlin itself, Granlin says, basically, if the government wants to introduce this evidence, this is what it has to do. And it doesn't give any other options. It doesn't say or. And it also,
I mean, the procedural rules are written in mandatory terms quite often. The government shall, this shall not be admitted, this shall be admitted. And then if you don't make an objection to it, you are not able to raise it on appeal. It's just that simple.
Well,
I see no reason why this should be an exception to that rule.
Well, the trial lawyer did say, he objected, he said, I'll make the constitutional objection. And then he talked about Sixth Amendment hearsay. And that's what this is. It is testimonial hearsay evidence. And, you know, what more was he supposed to object to? You do have the district court in this case that once he makes the objection, the district court just overrules without any explanation. The probation officer that's testifying is not even Mr. McElroy's own probation officer, but just the stand-in. And then he makes another objection, the same objection I previously made regarding the Sixth Amendment hearsay. And that's after it's already admitted. I do think, like I said, you know, looking at the Granlin criteria, you know, it's this court's rule. If the court doesn't want to enforce the rule, I think the court can rescind it, or just say that it doesn't have to be enforced. It becomes actually a suggestion.
Let me ask you this: Is it fair to say that your argument here is that the government, if they could do it, they were required to prove that the quantity of the was such that it was high enough to exclude passive ingestion, and the government didn't do that, and your client's counsel did raise that objection that the test did not exclude passive ingestion, and therefore there's insufficient evidence in this record for the government to meet its burden that the ingestion was knowingly. Is that your argument in a nutshell on that issue?
Yes, Your Honor. You know, and going back to Granlin, I think if the government had complied with Granlin, with what we see with the three criteria, it might have taken care of that issue. But since it didn't comply with Granlin, that issue, yes, is still present and it's insufficient.
Okay, yes. Thank you, counsel. We have your argument. Mr. Smythe, we realize that you were court appointed and we appreciate your willingness to serve the court, and you've done an excellent job for your client. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.